remember once I was with Jonathan Talbot at the sandbar over there, Skycomish River. It was early in the morning before a tracking club really got started, and we heard all this intense noise up in the trees. It was Stellar's jays. First, it was just Stellar's jays making a racket, aiming at one thing up in about halfway up a cedar. So we listened to that for a little while and kind of got interested, but we didn't really pay too much attention. But when the crows started gathering, well, we couldn't ignore it anymore. And you remember that? We walked into the woods over there. We headed back to see what it was. And it had to be an owl. I mean, that was all it could be, and it turned out to be an owl. But what it really was a great horned owl that had just finished swallowing a barn owl. And it clipped off the feet of the barn owl and dropped them below its perch, as well as a bunch of barn owl feathers, just so we could be sure we knew what it was. And that was just before it flew off. That story predated the story of the raven in the same forest, which was very close by. That's why I had thought owl that day, because I remembered very, very well the barn owl being swallowed by a great horned owl. So owls in the forest, especially an owl in the act of swallowing a barn owl, will definitely get the attention of the other birds around it, especially jays and crows. So continuing on our journey to really understanding bird language, pretty much you guys have to get good at listening to disturbances in the baseline, investigating them, using all of your resources, knowing what trails are there, knowing what the birds are usually doing in that area, and putting two and two together. And that's the key to the whole thing. I remember very clearly when I first arrived in Western Washington, all of the intense winter wren alarm activity down low in this one particular thicket all day long. And I said to one of the caretakers on the property, I said, "Are there a lot of weasels around here? Because I can't explain," I didn't say I can't explain why the winter wrens are acting that way. I just simply asked, "Are there a lot of weasels around here?" His response was, "No, never see any." And I thought to myself, huh, I guess maybe winter wrens are just random in Washington. They just make random sounds, and they just get all agitated and excited and waste a lot of energy here for no reason at all. Maybe there's a lot of spiders, you know, so they're getting so much food that they have nothing better to do than to pretend they're alarmed at something. And I'm thinking to myself, no, that doesn't make any sense at all. There's definitely something in the thicket that I'm not seeing. And I paid really careful attention to them for a while. I would sit up on the porch and watch out over the forest. The porch was like a balcony overlooking salmonberry thickets. And from that perch, I could tell that this alarm behavior was kind of concentrating around sort of a log pile that was in one location. And the alarm intensity would come and go from that log pile. So I began to realize there was definitely something down in the salmonberry thicket. But what it was, I couldn't see. And having just moved there from New Jersey, I didn't know whether or not there really were weasels or not. I looked in the field guides. I saw that there was weasels on the range map, but I wasn't really 100% sure that I was really listening to weasel alarms. I was really trying to figure out what else could possibly cause this. So I looked into the snake possibilities of the area, and what I found out was that there was no snakes except for garter snakes, and garter snakes really just don't cause that kind of alarm in a winter wren. Just doesn't happen. There wasn't really any bird-eating snakes. Like where I was from, especially in the Pine Barrens, there was a couple of species of snakes that were real good at eating birds, and I heard a lot of bird alarms around those particular kind of snakes, like pine snakes and rat snakes, but there was no such snake in this area that could explain the alarm. So I just went down the list, and that's pretty much what you guys are going to do too. You're just going to eliminate possibilities until you get only one or two possible choices of what could be causing that particular bird language pattern. And once you get down to one or two, then it's just going to be a matter of time before you find out the answer to your question. You just have to be consistent. So my question got answered on a 9-mile drive that I took from the property across the Snoqualmie Valley down a particular road that we followed every day. And down that 9-mile road, I was traveling at the very beginning of July, which seems to have significance in the weasel world. And during that drive, I counted 7 road-killed weasels on that one day. And in my years driving in New Jersey, I can tell you that I probably drove 1,000 miles more like 10,000 miles to see seven dead weasels. So what I'm saying is that not only are weasels in Washington, but they're very common in Washington. There's a lot more weasels than there are per acre in New Jersey, that's for sure. And the reason there are so many weasels is because there's an enormous diversity of insect life, which is feeding an enormous diversity of insectivores, shrews and moles. And beyond that, also, we're blessed in Washington with a lot of voles and mice. So that's why there are so many weasels here. And just to illustrate that, I was with Max Stewart and Ann Osbaldesson, instructors from the school, one day when we were going to move an old Volkswagen that had been parked for a little while in the forest. And when we opened the hood, we discovered a box, a cardboard box that had a pile of weasel poop next to it. It smelled really strongly of weasel's droppings. When we opened the box and looked inside of it, there was a big fluffy nest with four baby weasels in it. And there was no less than 25 shrew moles in a pile. And not one of the shrew moles was stiff with rigor mortis. They were all fresh and floppy. Some of them were already eaten in half. And while we were there, the mom came back with another shrew mole. So she was making so many trips out in the forest to get shrew moles to feed those four young. Just gave us an idea just how many shrew moles there are inside a weasel's territory. It's amazing how much life is actually there. And if you sit in the forest in Washington really quietly for hours, you're not going to see more than two or three shrew moles maybe in that time period. So it just goes to show you that there's a lot more going on behind the scenes than you can really see with your eyes. And that's why bird language is so helpful. It really begins to help you see beyond the covering of the leaves, and beyond that the leaf litter and the thickets, right? So that's how bird language instructed me in the very beginning when I first moved here, that there were a lot of weasels in Western Washington, even though the local people who had been living there for many years had never seen one. Doesn't mean that they're not there just because you don't see them. So if the bird language behavior at your secret spot tells you that there has to be weasels there, there has to be weasels there. I mean, there's no other explanation. Birds do not act in a random manner. So that's what going to your secret spot is all about. You know, when you start to notice these anomaly and patterns in bird language and behavior, and you start to notice that it's associated with animal trails, how can you ignore it? You know, what you'll do in the beginning is tell yourself that you didn't really see that. You know, you'll doubt yourself. That's just part of the process. Now, when you're out there and you're looking for your secret spot, you know, how do you know you've found a good one? Well, the parameters I always tell people are, and this is what gets us in trouble because people go looking for these ideal parameters. How about you try to get as many of these parameters as you can? You know, as best you can. Don't try to get all of them in one place because you'll spend the rest of your life searching for them. And that seems to be a hang-up for people. They're out there trying to find exactly what I explained. But I'm only suggesting these as goals. If you can't put them all together, don't worry about it. My secret spot didn't have water at it. It just didn't. I was on the top of a hill, and that hill looked out in three directions down to the forest below, and there was a little wetland at the far, very far edge of my secret spot. Sort of, I could see it in the wintertime. If I looked really hard through the forest, I could see that wetland. So it was that far away in the wintertime in the east. There's no underbrush to disturb your view. So it's not like I was looking at a creek. But I always recommend to people, if they have the choice, they should try to get into a place where there's a pond edge or a creek going by, because anywhere water is, especially in a drier habitat, that's where all the life is going to concentrate. All life will at least pass by the water and come to it. Predators come there to see who's drinking, and they also come to drink themselves. There's fish in the water. There's fish eaters along the edge of the water. There's frogs and things that feed mink, and then all manners of things that feed along the land come to the water to drink. So the idea being that the more diversity you can get at your secret spot, the better it will be, the faster you'll learn. Okay, so that's the idea. But if you can't get water, don't worry about it. I didn't have water at my spot. I learned a lot of my water knowledge, the things of water, from fishing a lot. So the other thing is, where grass meets edge, like thickets, where grass meets a salmonberry thicket or a blackberry thicket, that's always a really good place to go too. So where lawns meet forest edges, where forest edges of one kind meet forest edges of another. For instance, old growth oak forest coming up upon the edge of a second growth tulip forest. This would be an edge. So any place where there's a lot of edges intersecting between different kinds of environments, that's a really good place to put a secret spot. It's also good to put a secret spot in a place where you can see. So you don't want to go sit in the middle of a blackberry thicket. For one thing, it hurts getting in and out. For another thing, you can't see outside of it. It's like sitting inside of a bubble. You want to have a view. But that doesn't mean you should climb to the top of a tree as your secret spot. You should definitely be down low with the birds themselves, because if you're down at their level, you'll get to understand more. Although being up in a tree fort in a tree stand is helpful, because then you have a bigger view, a larger perspective on things. Okay, so it does help to have a view. It helps to have a lot of different kinds of ecosystems interacting in one place, and water is really helpful. But I can tell you, the single most important factor in choosing your secret spot has to be convenience. If it's not near your house, if you can't walk to it in 2 minutes, I guarantee you won't use it. And if you don't use it, you won't learn. It's that simple. So make sure you pick a place that's close enough where you're actually going to be inspired to go to it on a regular basis. That's very, very vital. Okay, what are the things you do when you get to your secret spot? Well, there's a lot of different things to do. When we get around to teaching you the routine of invisibility, those are the specific things you'll learn to use on your way to your secret spot, when you're standing off in the distance looking towards your secret spot, when you get to your secret spot, how do you use the routine of invisibility. Those are things that you're going to do to and from the secret spot, so we'll get to that later. You can add that later. One of the things that I always recommend to people is that the first thing they do at their secret spot is get to know the four directions very specifically. The first day you go to your secret spot, you might think, oh, that's east, that's south, this is west, that's north. But after going to your secret spot a few times, you might start to realize that the sun doesn't always rise in the same place. It rises in a different place in summer than in winter. So what you thought was east might not be east after all. And after being there for a few months, you begin to realize that the sun at noon is always in this one particular place, and that's when you finally figure out where south really is. Or maybe you go there at night and you look at the North Star, and then you say, oh, geez, I was off like 15 degrees. But that's just how it is. Just make it a goal of yours to get to know the four directions at your secret spot. You don't have to get it right the first day. You don't have to necessarily bring a compass the first day out there, but that's not a bad idea. Something that one of our bird language instructors told me to remind you of is timekeeping. That she said one of the most helpful things she had in learning bird language that really sped up the process was marking 10-minute intervals, so that when you go to your secret spot, notice every 10 minutes. And I don't like to make people really become obsessive about time, especially bringing watches to their secret spot. That's kind of, it seems like almost like hypocritical to the whole process, but it really isn't, because it speeds up your learning curve. Because it's very hard to remember. If you go and sit at your secret spot for an hour and then go back home to your desk and try to remember what happened in sequence, it's really hard to remember, you know, what things happened in what order. So she was telling me that the most helpful thing that she realized, and she got this from other community school students too, that 10-minute interval thing was really helpful. Every 10 minutes we would give a raven call while people were at their secret spot. And then when they reported back after their time at their secret spot, they would say, in the first 10 minutes, this is what happened around my secret spot. And in the second 10 minutes, this is what happened. In the third 10 minutes, this is what happened. It's easier to remember those 10-minute blocks than it is to remember 1 hour without any separation. Okay, so just timekeeping is helpful. And for that reason, keeping a little notepad with you is also helpful. In the beginning, later on, you're going to want to graduate away from both the watch and the notepad. But if you use the watch and the notepad, your brain will begin to organize things and remember things in order and logical fashion. So the notepad will help you. So you might notice that I was at my secret spot for 20 minutes. There was no bird calls around me. Everything was quiet. And then I noticed at 20 minutes that the robin finally started feeding again nearby, and then a thrush began to sing. So you just note that down. You know, maybe on your notepad, it doesn't say anything. You just write quiet. And then at the 10-minute break, you write first 10 minutes. Or maybe you note the time, 10 after 1. You got there at 1 o'clock, nothing was happening. 1:10, nothing. 1:20, robin feeding to the east, thrush singing. Right? So then that's kind of how your notes are. You're just sort of making little outline type notes. When you get back later to home, you're going to develop them in a way that I'll explain in a minute. Okay, so essentially what you're doing is you're actually just making observations at your secret spot. What is everybody doing while I'm hanging out there? That's the whole idea. Okay, so you'll begin to notice different quality of behaviors as you get better and better at the routine of invisibility. For instance, I would deliberately at the community school start the new students off by not teaching them the routine of invisibility and causing them to go to their secret spot in a hurry, so they would create an enormous alarm sequence around themselves, get to their secret spot, it would be dead silent for the first 20 minutes, and then after 20 minutes things would begin to pick up. So they would make those observations, and I would use the art of questioning when they got back. What did you notice in the first 10 minutes? And pretty much what they would all be saying is nothing. In the second 10 minutes, they didn't really observe anything. In the third 10 minutes, they noticed bird alarms starting to come, bird language starting to return, birds feeding, that sort of thing. So they would just make those observations that it took at least 20 minutes for baseline to return. So that was the process of journaling that taught them that. So after they've been doing this for a few weeks, then I'd teach them the routine of invisibility and teach them how to go to their secret spot without disturbing the birds. And then when they would go down there, they'd notice that there was bird song the whole way with a few alarms going off as they were walking. And so they began to notice their own reflections. So that's how we worked it there at the community school. That's how we work it there still. And that works very well. The other thing we would have them do is actually count airplanes passing over. Because even though it doesn't seem like important information, it is amazing to note just how little people are really paying attention. For instance, one young fella, he says, I said, how many airplanes passed by while you were out there at your secret spot? And he said, 3. But I had told one of my more advanced instructors at the community school, Justin Shetler, I said, Justin, how many planes went by? He said, 7. And the other kid says, no, there was only 3. And he says, no, there were 7. So then I made that other kid in charge of counting planes. And from that day forward, it was amazing how many more planes he actually heard. Because what happens is when you're out at your secret spot a lot of times, is you just sort of get busy thinking. And you tune out the environment, and planes fly overhead. You don't notice them going over. What else have you missed during that time? So counting planes isn't such a bad idea. What sounds are you hearing? Dogs barking in the distance, a train going by, hearing voices of people talking in the distance, hearing a chainsaw. Don't tune those things out. Note them down in your notepad. You'll be surprised at how much this information begins to come together later in ways that you didn't realize. For instance, you begin to notice that a jet flying over actually stops the spring peepers from singing, the vibration of the jet passing. You'll also notice that the sudden cessation of frogs at the pond was related to the train passing in the distance. The rumble of the ground actually stopped the frogs from singing. You begin to pick up these things, and you will start to realize how interconnected everything really is. That whole concentric ring thing will become more evident to you. There is no observation that should be ignored at your secret spot. You can't make notes on all of it because you have to participate in some of it. So my recommendation is you keep that little notepad on your lap and use a pencil, because if it's raining, pencils still write in the rain. While you're sitting there, you might notice, okay, there was a whole flurry of activities, a bunch of little birds flew over. So you just note it down. Little birds flew over going west to east over the pines. And you leave it be. And then you're sitting for a while, and what should I write down next? Well, you don't have to worry about it. If it's not jumping into your mind, don't write it down. Eventually you'll begin to figure out what you should pay attention to and what not to pay attention to. Okay, so what do you do with this information? Well, more important than just making notes in that little notepad is the actual development of that information after you get home. We make people, during those bird language training programs at the community school, we make them map every single time they're out there. When they come back, I don't care how many times they've drawn the pond, how many times they've drawn their secret spot, they do it every single time. Just like in the independent studies program, the Kamana Naturalist training program, you have to map your secret spot every single time you're out there. There's a reason for that. by mapping it over and over and over again, your brain really begins to recognize in more and more excruciating detail the very many nuances and aspects of your natural environment around you. That's when bird language really begins to make sense. The more you know your place, the better you'll be able to interpret the bird language. So it's very important that you always draw your map. And if you look at the little booklet that comes with this tape series, or if you're a Kamana student, this will be familiar to you. Look at the maps that we've shown to you here as examples. Notice that they're not all that detailed. They're just sort of skeletons that kind of indicate the basic aspects of the landscape, so you can recognize landmarks. You've already gotten to know where the oak tree is and where the thicket is and where the deer trail is. But if the deer trail isn't being used, there's no need to draw it every single time. But if in this particular case, while you're at your secret spot, the deer trail has bird alarms going down it, well, then you might want to include the deer trail. So you'll know what to include and what not to include based on what things you're keeping track of. So if an event, the very first event that you notice is a squirrel suddenly bursting out of the thicket, climbing a tree and waving its tail all around and making a clucking sound, and then a robin gives an alarm and flips its tail and flies over nearby, and then a chipmunk goes off, those would be three events, one, two, and three. So what you might do is put on your map, number one, where the squirrel was, number two, where the robin came from and drew a dotted line to where it landed, and number three, where the chipmunk sound came from. And when you look at it from a bird's eye view, looking down on the map, you'll notice that it all kind of points that there was one particular area that the disturbance emanated from. And then you'll start to say, gee, I should have looked inside of that thicket. Maybe there was something in that thicket that caused that alarm. And probably there was. There was probably a weasel or something right in that thicket at that moment. So that's how mapping works. So again, just kind of look at the little booklet that comes with the tape and you'll get to understand that. So eventually, when you get home and you've done the map and you've kind of recreated it, it's a good idea to do a little journaling at that point, to actually try to tell the story over again from your memory of what happened. Go back in your mind, remember the events as you saw them, remember the events as you heard them, and try to tell the story. In the beginning, you'll be really struggling. You won't have a clue what to write. But in time, you'll begin to recognize patterns. This is just like tracking. This is just like following footprints. But instead of following footprints through the snow or sand or through the forest debris, what you're now doing is following footprints through the bird alarms. Bird alarms are your medium. You'll begin to recognize that all of these alarms have a shape and an intensity and a movement and a direction. You'll begin to see these things. You'll begin to read the concentric rings. Stalking Wolf always asked Tom what's called the sacred question, and Tom always asked me the same question. After I was at my secret spot, he would call me in the evenings around dinner time and ask me lots of questions over the phone, interviewing me as to what I experienced. If you don't have someone in your life who's interviewing you, you have to interview yourself, and that's why journaling is so important. And the sacred question is simply this: what did I observe? What is this telling me? And then beyond that, what is it teaching me? So you're constantly driving yourself deeper into the question. Okay, what did I observe? I observed a squirrel squirt out of the forest, out of the litter, and climb a tree and whip its tail around. I observed a robin give an alarm and fly over and flip its tail. I observed or heard chipmunks popping nearby. So that's what I observed. What is it telling me? Well, what it's telling me is that three different species are all erupting because of some similar feeling that they're having. Okay, so that's what it's telling me, that there's some pattern to this. What is it teaching me? Go deeper into it. What it's teaching me is that there's something invisible that I'm not seeing. Something is in the landscape that's teaching me or telling me about the forest, and I'm not able to see it, so I have to learn to look deeper. That's what it's teaching me. I have to go deeper next time. I have to go back there tomorrow and investigate that area to see if there's a possible weasel den right in that thicket. That's what I overlooked when I was sitting there. But it is always in going back at home at night and reflecting over what you experienced during the day that the really good questions come up in your mind that tomorrow will drive you to look even closer and to try even harder. So that's why journaling is so important. In the old days, Stalking Wolf didn't need to do journals because his elders would ask him questions when he got back, right? Tony Tenfinger sees not Apache, but he's Lakota, he tells the story of his uncle. And he always says how I thought my uncle was so dumb. Because when I got back home, my uncle would ask me all these questions as if he didn't know anything at all. And in the beginning, when I was a kid, I thought he didn't know anything and I was just teaching him things. But when I realized that when I got older, what my uncle was doing was interviewing me to make me look deeper and to learn more from my own observations. So it was his questions that drove me to look even harder. And we call that the art of questioning in our art of mentoring programs. That's a really important skill to learn. It was part of the package of culture that Native people had that caused their children to pay attention to things they otherwise would not have noticed. So maybe you can call that the antidote to adolescent self-absorbed behavior. In our case, if we don't have the elders to ask those questions, who's going to ask those questions of us? That's where your journaling comes in. That's when you remind yourself every day to map and to journal. If you join the independent study programs, that's basically what we're going to force you into doing anyway. We're going to make you map and journal all the time. That's the core of it, because that's how you learn. Okay, so you'll learn eventually to go deeper, and eventually you'll even learn to read into the feelings of the moment. So what you might notice, for instance, is next time an alarm takes place at your secret spot, that you sense it in your heart before you even hear it. All of a sudden you get like a bolt come into your body. You feel that concentric ring, a sudden jolt into your heart, and you suddenly feel like this intense tension. And then the alarms go off, and you're like, wow. When you're journaling later, you notice, hey, I had this really funny feeling, this sudden burst of feeling, and then I heard the alarms right after it. I wonder. You know, so that's what you're observing. This time you're observing. What did I observe? I observed a feeling in myself before I heard the alarm. What is that telling me? What that tells me is that I'm tuned in to something that I can't see, just like the animals are. What is it teaching me? Well, it's teaching me that I better pay more attention to my feelings, because in this case, there really was an alarm. That's how it works. Okay, so finally, I'm reflecting back to the Way of the Coyote class, the first one that Tom and I taught in January of 1999, when I was sending people out during that class to learn this bird mapping exercise that I'm teaching right now here in this tape and through the booklet. We were sending groups out to do this very exercise. And when we came back in, we were asking questions, using the sacred question to analyze this information. When Tom walked in and said, let's take it a little deeper. If you want to know what the bird was feeling, why don't you just ask the bird? You know, what does he mean by that? Eventually, you're starting to realize that you can become empathetic enough from this kind of training that the bird will tell you exactly what it's thinking. And really, quite literally, when the bird sees something that it's alarmed about, the bird can communicate to you very effectively exactly what it's feeling. It's just a matter of you learning to be sensitive enough, to be familiar enough with that particular bird. Remember what I said about learning robins. You know, if you study the robins in your yard long enough, eventually you're going to figure out every mood and nuance that they have from their body language and voice. Once you learn how to do that with robins, you'll be able to do that with every bird. Okay, so you can literally learn it directly from the birds. Okay, now the last piece of this is, hey, what if I travel or I don't live in one place? You know, how am I going to learn this bird language stuff? Well, the trick to traveling is, if you are a person who travels around a lot and you realize that it's important for you to get out and practice this kind of thing every day, what are you going to do about that secret spot thing? Well, in this case, instead of choosing a place, choose an environment type. So in other words, if you have a secret spot at home that you get to visit once a week, that's a lawn with a thicket edge along one side of it. Then wherever you're traveling, look for a lawn with a thicket edge, because you'll probably encounter the same bird species. Okay, so the same thing, instead of anchoring on a place, anchor on a species. If the bird you were choosing to study at home was the robin, then study robins wherever you go, because, all right, they're going to vary from place to place and individuals are going to be different, but still, robins will still have songs and calls that are similar from place to place. So I know it's a compromise, it's not ideal, but you don't say that you have to give up because you're not in one place all the time. Same thing if you live in the city. In the city, just go to your local park. And I know John Gallagher tells you this on the phone when you call in if you're an independent study student, that don't complain that you don't have a good secret spot, because the very first Kamana graduate, Jonathan Talbot, his secret spot was a one square block of a city park with a few oak trees and some grass, and that's where he went for a year. He would go out into the woods whenever he got the chance to add to his knowledge, but every day he was out in that secret spot, which was exactly 25 steps from his front doorstep. And he was very successful in learning bird language and language of squirrels and crows. A lot of neat stuff happens in the city if you just pay attention. There's sharpshins, hawks living in the city, falcons, peregrine falcons even, red-tailed hawks flying over. There's still house cats moving around, and all this stuff is still happening in the city. It just looks a little bit different than it does in the country. So it does work in the city. And there's a student now, more advanced student in our community school named Ricky Scandora, who assures us that learning bird language can be done in the city. She lives right down in Seattle, and she practices bird language out at her secret spot every week at the community school, but she sees all the same things going on right there in Seattle that she sees out in the woods, and she assures us that having a secret spot in the city, which for her is a tree up the street on the edge of a park, is just as effective as it is in the country. In fact, sometimes you'll notice that it's more effective in crowded places because the animals are more concentrated and there's more activity going on in the city. So don't give up on the city. You know, just make sure that you have a routine and that you're actually doing something out there every day, and by all means getting back and journaling at night, especially mapping, because that's when you'll begin to see the shape and direction of the concentric rings themselves. Let me tell you some more about alarmer specifics. That is, who's giving the alarm. The song sparrow is a bird of the thicket that lives along the edge of fields and grasslands, and fortunately for us, it's everywhere all across the country. So if I'm going to go to California, I'm just as likely to see a song sparrow on the edge of the forest as I am to see one in New Jersey, or for that matter, at a rest area in the middle of Wisconsin while I'm traveling on I-90. So song sparrows are very useful birds. They usually are in pairs. They have a very defined territory. It's not very big. And it's usually the same kind of territory. So your typical suburban yard or farm country backyard will have at least a pair of song sparrows, and probably more. Song sparrow males tend to fly up to the top of little thickets. They tend to be singing from head height or lower, maybe a little higher sometimes, but usually head height or lower. And they have a very specific song that starts with three notes that are the same. And song sparrows are great because their companion call is real reliable. When they're feeding, they'll talk to each other. I remember down at the edge of the Sky River again in Washington, we'd gotten there to do a tracking club, and I had sent the group out to do some tracking, and I was hanging around the fire circle waiting for the first break when we all gathered back together, when I noticed a male song sparrow calling insistently from the edge of a blackberry thicket. And he came down onto the sandbar there, and he was hopping along where a little slough passes through. And he was calling so nervously. He was calling and calling and calling and calling. And I just got this feeling that he was looking for his mate. I mean, the feeling I got from it was, I'm really concerned. Where's my woman? Where's my woman? You know, he was calling and calling and calling. And the reason he was doing that was because we as a group had just kind of burst through there, and all these people scattered all over the place. So I think we must have bird plowed her right out of the territory. And now that everyone was gone off to do their thing, it had settled down enough where he was trying to call her back to see if she was okay. And sure enough, within about 30 seconds of his insistent calling, there she was. She came flying back in, and she answered with a reassuring sound, and he relaxed immediately and went back to feeding. And then the two of them began their scratching along the ground, giving their little soft call to each other. They were just out of sight of each other, and they were making that soft call that they always make when they're feeding. So song sparrows are great because they're always nearby. They tend to be a little bit shy enough to teach you some respect, but not so shy that they avoid you altogether. So I would definitely make the song sparrow something to study. They're really good at telling you about weasel alarms. They're real good at telling you about snakes. They're real good about telling about cats, foxes, coyotes. So song sparrow is definitely on your list. Juncos. I tell people this, and I believe this to be true, that the junco, if you have it in your territory, is one of the greatest teachers, because it is such a quiet little bird. it feeds, it's gray, slate gray, and as it feeds along the ground, it usually stays in shadowy places that match its coloration perfectly. If you're not really using your wide-angle vision or your peripheral vision, and if you're not really moving in a slow enough pattern where you can actually detect subtle movements, the junco will always get the best of you. And because the junco's voice is so quiet, when it does fly off and give its alarm note, if you're even slightly busy in your head or slightly noisy with your feet, you won't notice the junco making the alarm. So the junco is one of the greatest teachers of not only invisibility but bird language, because you have to learn to listen to the most silent place possible in order to hear the junco. I always tell people when they first learn bird language, you know, don't concentrate on the loudest bird. And as soon as I say listen to bird language and learn bird language, people will immediately train their ears on the closest bird sound. That's the loudest bird. And as soon as you train your ear to the closest bird sound, the more distant bird sounds become invisible to you. You can't hear them because they're beyond that kind of realm of listening, that you're attending your energy towards the most obvious bird sound. And by doing that, you're not listening to the quietest bird sound beyond it. Does that make sense? So I always tell beginners, learn to listen to the junco because it's the quietest sound. If you learn to listen to the silence of the forest instead, that's the best thing to do. That's what I was trained to do. Learn to listen to the silence in between the bird sounds. Then the bird sounds, no matter how far and subtle they are, will jump into your ears. Listening to the silence will teach you to hear the junco. Listen to this background silence, and the junco will jump out like a loud sound out of the environment. Does that make sense? You don't want to listen to the robin who's singing in your ear right here only. Oh, wow, I'm listening to bird language because I can hear that robin so well. Well, then you're going to miss the junco in the distance. So learn to listen to the silence, and that's when the very, very quiet junco noises in the distance will come to you. What does a junco companion call sound like? The junco companion call is like a very soft, almost like a tambourine sound, almost like a jingling sound. When they're down on the ground feeding, it is so quiet. And they're down in the grass feeding so that their beaks are facing the ground while they're making the sound. It's almost like only they can hear it among themselves. So remember to listen for that when you're out there. There's other birds that have really subtle, quiet calls like that also. Learning to train on the junco, you'll begin to really hear the bird language. When a junco bursts off the ground and flies away, it gives a little twitter sound as it flies off, and it flashes its black and white or dark gray and white tail patterns as it flies away. That bird, I swear, has got to be in the deer's right-hand front pocket in terms of being the most important bird to give away the approach of humans or the approach of predators. Because I notice that when deer are feeding and the juncos go off, even though the juncos are so quiet, the deer have such huge ears. They're like radar dishes, you know. They can pick up really subtle sounds in the distance. I can see a deer's ears zap towards that junco noise so quick. Deer really depend on juncos because juncos are ground feeders. So you learn to pay attention to juncos too. And the last one I'll talk about on this side of the tape before we get on to the next topic will be the towhee. The towhee is a very unusual bird in that it doesn't give vocal communication. It gives sound and visual communication, as I explained on the first tape. You learn early on that towhees, when they finally do fly up into the trees and give an alarm, it's way beyond the early warning stage. So when you hear a towhee giving its towhee call or its call that it gives sometimes like that, especially in the Northwest, the local towhees here, by the time they give a vocal sound, the danger is well past. You know, they're already kind of out of the safe zone. A towhee doesn't really express itself vocally until the danger has passed. They tend to alarm first by becoming silent. They tend to alarm first by freezing. So like the junco, the towhee is a great challenge to your awareness because it doesn't make very much noise except for feeding sounds. You have to pay extra special attention in order not to miss the cues that it's giving you. And I will also tell you, as we'll repeat later on tape 4, the towhee is the last to arrive on the scene of baseline, and it's one of the first to leave. So learning the TOEI, if you can move through the landscape without disturbing the TOEIs, you're really accomplishing something. So look at the TOEI as kind of like the ultimate motion detector. So more on this as we continue on with tape three, which we'll start to deal more specifically with profiles of bird language and how it relates to you as the bird observer.
To www.natureoutlet.com for information on John Young and Wilderness Awareness School's classes, expeditions, tapes, home study courses, and intensive mentoring opportunities. Thank you for listening.